welcome once again to The Blueprint. It is Canada's conservative podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Schmale, Member of Parliament for Halliburton, Kawartha Lakes, Brock. Thank you once again for joining us. We have new content every single Tuesday, 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And with that information, we need your help. We need you to like, comment, subscribe, share this program, help us push back against the ever-moving Liberal agenda, because the information we're just about to talk about on this program is very important, and we need to encourage you to, as I said, like, comment, subscribe, share, and that way there might be someone in your social network, somewhere on your friends' network that might be open to hearing the conservative message, or at least hearing an opposing piece of information that you wouldn't necessarily hear from mainstream media. So this is your way to help us push back against that agenda and ensure that Erin O'Toole is the next Prime Minister of Canada. And if you can't watch it all now on Facebook, you can download the content, listen to it on platforms like CastBox, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, you name it, it is out there. So without further ado, we have coming back to the show a great friend of the program. He's been on many times before, Garnet Jennis, the Member of Parliament for Sherwood Park, Fort Saskatchewan. He's also the Shadow Minister for International Development and Human Rights. We welcome him back, Garnet.
Thank you, Jamie. It's so great to be with you. I love this platform always a pleasure to be part of it.
So the main area we're going to be covering is basically building on the conversation we had with Michael Chong on last week's program. And again, you can go to any of the platforms on Facebook, Google Play, iTunes, Spotify, CastBox. If you haven't heard it or watched it yet, it might be a good one to get caught up. So we're going to build on that. So in the meantime, though, the report from the Canada-China Committee has come out with a series of recommendations. You're on that committee. What are some of the recommendations and what happened?
Yes, I'll just say, first of all, last week was a great week in terms of Parliament standing up to the government. In our system, Parliament elected legislators should be driving the conversation on important issues and pushing the government to respond to what we are hearing from our constituents. So we saw that with the vote on the Uyghur genocide on Monday, parliamentarians voting, even though cabinet refused to participate in that vote. Then on Thursday, we had tabled in the House of Commons a consensus report reflecting the views of all parties on the Special Committee on Canada-China Relations on the situation in Hong Kong. And again, this report was really going much further on these issues than the government has gone, pushing the government to step up and take a strong response. So it calls for sanctions in response to what's happening in Hong Kong. It calls for meaningful immigration measures to help people, especially in the democracy movement, be able to seek a safety in Canada. It calls for universal suffrage for people in Hong Kong, in line with the commitments that were made at the time of the handover. So many very strong recommendations that the government really has not been willing to take on up to now. And Conservatives have been pushing the government, now that we have been able to get, in the context of that committee, at least all party support for what we're seeking, it's really time for the government to stop dithering and move forward. I think we hear this so often on the China file. The government says, we're considering this, we're considering that, we're considering everything. Well, time to stop considering and time to start doing something.
So for those people that may have forgotten about what has been going on in Hong Kong, it's been in and out of the headlines, but over the past summer, it was really front and center because of a number of issues. Maybe you can just give us a quick rundown on a bit about what is going on, just to give some context to your previous comment.
Absolutely. And the way international news often gets covered, we hear a fragment of a story here and then attention shifts to something else. And events don't stop unfolding, even if something else has captured the attention of the media. So, I mean, the situation in Hong Kong going back is that at the time it was handed over and became, in a certain sense, part of China, it was under the framework of a one country, two systems agreement, that Hong Kong would be part of China, but it would be able to maintain its distinct political and economic system. And there has been, unfortunately, really a steady attack on those commitments since the beginning, but a real escalation under Xi Jinping. And it has culminated in the advancement of a national security law, so-called, which effectively ends any kind of autonomy for Hong Kong, because it allows, under the guise of national security, the government in Beijing to do to do virtually anything in terms of exercising its control. And there have been many examples since of legislators disqualified, of people arrested simply for things that they've said in media. So this movement away from commitments that the government of China had made, and it's really striking in terms of its violation of international law here. The government of China had made binding commitments, they as part of this handover, and now they're just totally ignoring those commitments. So we need to have a strong response that demonstrates how seriously we take the failure of the government of China to adhere to their international commitments. If we don't respond forcefully and effectively when these kinds of violations of human rights and international law take place, then we're just incentivizing this behavior from the government of China and other actors going forward. So this is why when we see the Uyghur genocide, the horrific situation in Hong Kong, acts of aggression in the South China Sea, efforts at foreign interference here in Canada and around the world, if we don't respond to those events, if we don't try to deter those kinds of actions, then the situation is going to continue to get worse.
So there's a few things I want to unpack there. One you said right at the beginning, and I don't want to kind of lose sight of that. We've always known the Communist Party to be quite powerful in China. But you said something that was, I think, very important. Over the last few years, I would say maybe seven, you might argue differently, but there's been a real major crackdown on people, what they can do, what they can say, how they can think. And it's always been that way. I'm not saying it hasn't, but it just seems to be very aggressive. And it also ties into what is going on with the Uyghurs as well.
Yeah, so definitely there's sort of a the one hand and the other hand thing, right? I think liberals now are trying to overstate the degree to which China has changed in even the last 2 years, because it's their way of justifying really the radically pro-appeasement policy they pursued at the beginning of their mandate. I mean, there were discussions about having extradition negotiations between Canada and China. That's how far the Trudeau Liberals were prepared to go. So they're trying to walk some of those things back a little bit by saying, look how much the government of China has changed in the last couple of years. And I mean, you know, 1989 Tiananmen Square shooting. I mean, there are many aspects of this political system that have been evident in their abuse of human rights going back a long time. But there's no doubt as well that there are particular policies being pursued by the Xi Jinping regime, a real extreme hardening in terms of the repression and escalating violations of human rights as well. So, we should recognize that trajectory. It's not as if there weren't problems before, but there is a hardening there in the nature of these abuses. And the other thing is the international context has changed around what the government of China is doing. At one time, the rhetoric was a lot around, the phrase was, China is, I think it was Deng Xiaoping who said, China's prepared to hide its strength and bide its time. There was this rhetoric that was pushed out internationally. They would say, well, we're a developing country, and we're focusing right now on human rights improvements in terms of economic development, but who knows what might come next. There was almost the implication that we're living in a largely democratic world, and maybe we'll get there. So I'm not explicitly saying that, but there is this kind of implication. And now it's the tone is totally different. From hiding and biding to wolf warrior diplomacy, where the government of China is being much more aggressive in terms of saying, we have a communist system, and we're not ashamed of it, and it's not going to change, and we're trying to create a world where we can really dominate it and favor other actors in other countries whose institutions look more like ours. I think that's a real betrayal of where a lot of people in China had hoped the system would move. And it shows, I think, that liberalization is possible but not inevitable. You can't presume that there's some sort of inevitable trajectory of history, that things can get better and things can get worse, and it really depends on the decisions that key actors make. It depends on the decisions we make. If we send the message now, as Xi Jinping is trying to harden the regime, this hardening is going to have negative consequences for the government of China and for the opportunities for relationship, then maybe there will be other people within that system who will try to find ways of starting to push back. But if we continue to take it, if we continue to accept this kind of bad behavior, then we're really we're incentivizing, unfortunately, further bad actions.
So when we talk about basically ignoring these bad actions, Canada, of course, within the cabinet, the government abstained from that very important vote, calling what is happening to the Turkic Muslims and the Uyghurs as genocide, basically allowing members of parliament to do the work for the government. This is an important part. And I asked Michael Chong this last week, and I'm interested to hear your comments as well. There are many other countries with a lot more to lose with relationships with China, such as Australia, with its proximity and its trading history, etc., that actually made a stand against what is going on in China with the Uyghurs and the Turkic Muslims.
Yes, you know, the politics of different countries are different. The pressures they're under are different. Australia has shown just immense courage in the context of their response to what the government of China is doing. You know, we need other countries to step up and take similar steps. Parliamentarians have shown courage here, courage that that our government has not shown. Shortly after we passed this resolution, the Dutch parliament passed a resolution as well. There is a legitimate desire to act multilaterally to respond to what the government of China is doing. But acting multilaterally doesn't mean we sit on our hands and wait for somebody else to act. It actually means that if we're prepared to be strong and lead, then it becomes easier for other countries to take those same steps as well. When it comes to the economic side, you know, we need to think thought carefully about this issue of strategic dependency, right? If we're in an economic kind of relationship where key sectors are dependent on the goodwill of the government of China, then we're highly vulnerable to arbitrary action. So part of protecting ourselves, you know, yes, having the courage, but also taking the steps that are necessary in terms of supporting domestic manufacturing, cultivating relationship with other countries' alternatives. This is what can reduce our strategic dependency on the government of China's arbitrary whims going forward.
Well, that's a beautiful segue into the next topic I want to talk to you about, is a statement our leader Aaron O'Toole wrote in the National Post, a bit of an op-ed, just talking about the need to deepen its ties with the world's largest democracy, that being India, and building on the relationship we've had. Maybe you can talk a bit about that, because that's I think, is a really big piece of the overall puzzle that you just mentioned.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, India is a major power regionally and globally. If you look at kind of the competition between democracies and the political model advanced by the government of China, you can see in Asia and Africa there are some areas where that competition is being waged, where there are different internal factions that are pushing for different kinds of things, or maybe trying to figure out how to integrate engagement with the West and with China. And then there are countries that are more likely to be a kind of bulwark against the aggressive actions of the government of China. I know India has been very critical of the Belt and Road Initiative, for example, which is an initiative of the government of China trying to extend its influence throughout the region. India has its own border disputes with China as well. You know, I guess one of the interesting things I just have to throw in here, I do a lot of advocacy around the Tibet issue, that the kind of that the treaty that India relies on for some of its claims, it was agreement between India and Tibet, And the government of China doesn't want to acknowledge that because they don't want to, of course, acknowledge the history of Tibet being on its own prior to the PRC invasion. So a lot of history there and a lot of complexity in terms of the different players. You know, I think there are economic opportunities to be pursued in terms of relationships with India. I think Canada should look for those opportunities, as our leader has said. I think, you know, there is also a lot of opportunities with countries in Africa. And as China tries to engage more in Africa, but do so in a way that's often quite predatory, that's associated with creating dependency through debt, we can take a different approach, which is to extend open-handed partnership and to seek to work on an equal, non-predatory, collaborative basis with countries in Africa and others in the region.
I couldn't agree with more, especially the strategy around Africa. And we talked about it with Michael Chong. I think we talked about it last time you were on the show as well, the predatory nature that China, the government of China, uses in a lot of the countries that are struggling. So I maybe we'll have you on for another time to talk about that, because I think we could talk for quite some time. We are running out of time, but I do want to touch on one other issue, that being the vaccines. It seems to be top of mind. Our health critic, Michelle Rempel-Gardner, and others on the committee, the health committee, are doing a fantastic job talking about this. We are noticing that Canada is falling further and further behind on kind of the world rankings in terms of getting the vaccine into people's arms. Obviously, that part is provincial, but it's securing the vaccine is the part that the federal government is responsible for. But we've also learned that part of the government strategy, because it put all its eggs in the Cancino basket, which was linked to the Communist Party, had links to it. We fell behind in securing vaccines from other suppliers. And this is a major problem on how this got rolled out. But yet we had to, as part of the government of Canada, raid a stockpile of vaccines, which was meant for the poorer countries that also need the vaccine. So Canada decided, well, we're just going to take some of that and then we'll make our numbers look better.
Yeah. So you're referring to the COVAX mechanism Yeah, I mean, there's some complexity around the mechanics of it in this sense. When COVAX was originally designed, a lot of people putting it forward said, well, let's have all countries get their vaccine supply from COVAX so that COVAX can ensure an equal distribution to everybody. You know, and it was up to countries to participate in that or not. And what most wealthier countries, including 6 out of 7 G7 countries, said is, well, maybe we'll donate some money to COVAX, but we're going to ensure our own domestic supply to ensure that we're putting our own nations at the front of the line. And people can debate that, but at the end of the day, it's the right of countries to make these decisions that are in their own interest. And many countries were saying we'll secure the supply we can and then provide for other countries afterwards. What Canada has been criticized for doing, though, is trying to kind of have their cake and eat it too, right? To say on the one hand, we're going to try to secure our own supply. And on the other hand, we're going to draw from COVAX, right? So we're not all in on COVAX, but we're still using COVAX, right? It's like if you're going to a potluck and you're eating your own food and eating other people's, you know, you're bringing your own meal, which you're not sharing, and you're eating other people's, you know, you kind of either got to be in one or in the other. That's kind of, and so the government has tried to muddy the waters a bit by saying, oh, the purpose of COVAX is for sharing. Well, I mean, yes and no, but it's a bit more complex than that. Look, this just demonstrates the government's failures when it comes to vaccines. And from an international affairs perspective, you know, countries are gaining a lot of capital if they're able to supply the rest of the world after supplying their own populations. The countries that are ahead on vaccines, you know, big benefits to their own country, but secondary to that, they're also building up international political capital by being able to contribute to the response elsewhere. And unfortunately, it just comes back to the government's failure on vaccines, failure to secure the production and the supply we needed. It's hurting Canadians. We know the impact of that, but it's also having negative implications in terms of the fact that we're drawing from COVAX instead of, if we had been further ahead, where other countries are going to be, which is being able to contribute earlier on in the process.
Garnet, we've gone way over time, but an amazing topic. We'll have to have you back again to talk even further about it. Any parting words? I always give the guests the last word, so maybe you can touch on a topic we haven't touched on, or just give final closing comments.
Well, Jamie, I'll just share a fun anecdote that we were talking about beforehand. So before getting elected, I was a political staffer, and it's so great to be able to work on these files with Michael Chong, because he when I was a staffer, I was working on the committee that he was chairing, which was the industry committee. And not only that, but Mark Garneau was the liberal critic on the industry committee at the time. And Anthony Rota, who's now the speaker, was there as well. So Michael's someone that I've worked with and looked up to for a long time coming out of a staffer career. And it's great to be able to work together with him on the foreign affairs file. And I know we gave Mark Garneau a lot of things to stick handle in those days. And, but this is a principal issue, the Uyghur issue and other things. And I would really challenge him to step up and do the right thing here. Not to think about this in terms of just a issues management day by day situation, but to think about the big consequences for the next generation, for the future of our country, about whether or not we're serious about standing up to this threat of authoritarian communism advanced by China.
Garnet Jennis, thank you very much for coming on the show. Once again, a good friend of the program, we will have you back. The Member of Parliament for Sherwood Park, Fort Saskatchewan, in the beautiful province of Alberta. He's also the Shadow Minister for International Development and Human Rights. If you liked what you watched or heard, please take into consideration liking, commenting, sharing, subscribing to this program. You can watch it here on Facebook, download it on CastBox, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, you name it. Together, we can push back against the ever-moving Liberal agenda. And hopefully, our goal, I think we all agree, is to make Erin O'Toole the next Prime Minister of Canada, and he'll be a great Prime Minister and lead this country. New content every single Tuesday. I was going to say Thursday, but Tuesday, 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We appreciate your support and watching us here today. Remember, low taxes, less government, more freedom. That's the blueprint.